See, she didn't forget.
I know I'm at the right meeting, Laverne, so. Long time no see.
No, thank you.
Dementia care is. Thank you.
Yes, you did. I did it.
You should do that to me every day, call me and say that.
I'm gonna be on time for this meeting.
Oh no, this is the county board meeting, sorry.
You want, this is agenda for tonight.
Oh, right here.
It's the first thing after the approval in the minutes.
On your mark, get set, go.
The time is 6:30, today is Monday, November 2nd, the chair will call the Human Services Committee meeting to order.
David Holman.
Present.
Michael Gable.
Yo.
Greg Rutzloff.
Here.
Leah Blau.
Here.
Aaron Decker.
Here.
Anita Johnson.
Here.
David Arrington, absent. Sarah Klimisch.
Here.
Jasmine Zeden.
Here.
All right, are there any citizen comments? Anyone wishing to speak or address the committee, please come forward, state your name and address for the record, you have 5 minutes. Seeing none, citizen comments is closed. Agenda item number 3, approval of the minutes of October 5th, 2015. Motion by Supervisor Blau, second by Supervisor Gable. Youth and Governance?
Aye.
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
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 Is there a motion to approve the minutes of October 19th, 2015 of the Joint Human Services Board and Human Services Committee?
So moved. Second.
Motion by Supervisor Decker, second by Supervisor Blau. Youth and Governance?
Aye.
Aye.
Committee?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Agenda item 4, discussion of the appointment of Frank Pacetti to the Kenosha County Workforce Development Board. Mr. Jansen?
Yes.
There have been some changes that are being made to this board?
Well, when we last talked, I had informed the board that we sent a copy of the new Workforce Initiative Opportunity Act, WIOA, board background requirements to Corporation Council for their review. Remember, this used to be WIA funding, so there was a different set of rules. The WIOA funding, when it comes to what Mr. Pacetti was filling, has become an optional board position. May include representatives of agencies or entities administering programs serving in local area relating to transportation and housing. And that was the requirement on the WIA board, but now it is not necessarily a requirement. I do believe someone with those type of qualifications would be beneficial to the board, but I certainly leave that up to this committee and the county board as a whole to make that decision.
Supervisor Johnson.
I just want to note that when this was returned to committee, it was advised to the board, from the board, that the sheriff be here to speak to the investigation. So I know that he wasn't informed about tonight, or chief deputy, were they informed about tonight to be here to speak to it as the board had requested when we returned it to committee. I still support that if we move forward with it. I think perhaps what I would like to see is actually to make a motion that we obsolete the position given the new requirements.
Is that a formal motion?
Yes.
there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Supervisor Johnson, seconded by Supervisor Decker. Can we do that? Or do they have to formally? I mean, we don't, their structure, we don't dictate that, do we?
The WIOA dictates the structure of the board. And like I said before, Mr. Pacetti was a reappointment through the WIA rules and regulations. Now that that is not, that position not is not necessarily a requirement, it can or can't be on the board. It doesn't really.
Now it's optional. So.
Regarding just those strict rules of what the board makeup should be, it is an optional position at this point in time.
Okay.
His specific position.
What he was fulfilling as part of housing and transportation.
Okay. So now that's optional.
Correct.
Okay.
It's not a requirement to be on the board.
From the standpoint of the county?
This is a, you know, the recommendation for this nomination comes through the mayor's office, and this is who the mayor put forward in order to fulfill that transportation and housing. And from a county perspective, I do believe that that is a position that could be valuable on that board. The decision now falls back onto you on whether or not.
Could we choose at a later date to have a recommendation?
Like a different person, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's the mayor's choice.
Yeah.
Well, if we decline this one, I'm sure we can get it there.
Maybe I don't. Okay. It'll be. I mean,
like I said, if we can't obsolete the position because it's now optional, I would. I know that I won't support it, and when it gets to the floor, I'll encourage others, remind them that we did send it back here for discussion with the sheriff, who hasn't been informed of tonight, so he's not here as we requested on the floor.
Supervisor Gable.
The sheriff, they all had an option the first time we did this.
He wasn't informed.
It was on the agenda.
He wasn't informed.
It was on the agenda.
It was the board that required at the meeting. They said have the sheriff.
When we reappointed Frank, it was a unanimous vote. Back in
that's October. Because this issue was not brought forward
what
by
issue?
Anyone.
The investigation wasn't brought up.
And what is an investigation? A lot of people are investigated. He's guilty of nothing. He's not arraigned, he's not anything.
It's still pending. And he's part of a civil suit right now. He is named in a civil suit.
Have you been to workforce development? Frank has been an asset to that committee because he is good at housing and transportation.
I don't think that's
we're appointing, it's a reappointment. The mayor is the one that chose Frank Pacetti.
We're the ones that approve it.
And so we're going to question everybody?
Mm-hmm. That's our job. That's our job.
First of all.
Okay, so we have Chairman Kubicki and then Supervisor.
Go ahead. No, go.
So
you can go.
This meeting was published and announced and what was going to be on, correct?
Yes, sir.
It wasn't my docket, so that's why, you know, that's why I'm here. And anybody can read, can understand what's being discussed tonight and everything else. So that's why I'm here. For that particular reason. Secondly, you're innocent until proven guilty. Anybody can have a DUI later on this month or whatever and you get charged, but until that point, you're not charged with anything. So I think you're putting the cart before the horse when you, and if you have personal dislikes against somebody, keep it personal. Don't keep it out here. If someone's thinking that don't want them on the workforce development, then don't put them on there. Plain and simple. But at the same token, don't sit there and be prejudgmental of something that hasn't happened yet. Some investigations go on for years. Some can go, as this one has already. So my point is this. Innocent till proven guilty, and if something comes out of the investigation, then someone can be removed at that time. But until that point, I think everything's fine the way it's going right now. Thank you.
Supervisor Ressler.
Go ahead. Terry can help.
Actually, Supervisor Decker was after.
Okay.
I'd like to make a motion to table.
Second.
Since, Supervisor Johnson said that the board requested we have the sheriff speak here, and he wasn't informed of the meeting.
Last time, he was informed to be here, but it wasn't on the agenda, so they showed up. This time, he wasn't informed. So, I mean, it's just, that's just not right. Last time, he was told to be here. He came, he had his representative here, and it wasn't on the agenda. So they came for nothing in the middle of the Obregon investigation. This time, they weren't even told about it. It's almost like somebody's intentionally trying to not get them here to talk, to speak to this.
What does the Kenosha sheriff have to do with this? He's not doing the investigation that's being done. It's being done by Racine.
He is. He's the sheriff. He's informed of many.
He's not doing the investigation.
He's met with them. That's why he needs to be here to speak to it. I'm sorry, but you're not the subject matter expert on the case, and you don't know what the sheriff does know and what he's privy to. That's why he needs to be here to tell us.
So, okay. What I'm hearing is that there's really two separate things going on here. There's those of you that want to talk about whatever potential criminal investigation details are going on. And there's a set that's saying maybe we can avoid even getting into the nastiness of that, because to be really honest, publicly, it doesn't look good for us. It just doesn't. So I would strongly encourage everyone, and I don't like the fact that we've gotten to this point, but it's going to take you all collectively to find a way out of this mess cleanly for him and for us. Just think about that in terms of some of the things that you're asking for.
I'd like to just say one more thing. Any decisions that he makes could be impacted by an indictment in the future. All decisions that he makes while he sits on the board, all of his votes, could be looked back upon and could open up a huge can of worms for us if that indictment goes through and he's convicted. Everything that he's done could be called into question. So we need to err on the side of caution, and we need to at least listen to the sheriff and what's going on. And that is why we would like to hold this off, table it.
That could be said about anybody on that board.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a motion to table. So, I mean, if we want to keep discussing and have the motion to table, that's an idea. But right now, we really need to deal with that as a motion.
Okay.
And so, I don't want to tell you to rescind it. But if you want to suspend it momentarily, because it sounds like there's some discussion you're okay with happening, I mean, it's entirely up to the two of you how you choose to go about it.
No.
So you want to just kind of let some discussion?
Well, you can speak to the table, right? To the motion at table?
Yeah, you can speak to the motion.
Supervisor Rose?
Well, if you're concerned about doing this in a diplomatic way, I think certainly tabling it is a diplomatic way of handling the issue. If you want to debate the wisdom of Frank Pacetti as an appointee, I'm fully capable and willing to do that. I made the motion here to refer it back to committee, and part of the motion was to meet with the sheriff. Now, I know all about presumption of innocence. This is not dealing with presumption of innocence. This is dealing with the substantive issue of what they are investigating and whether it's a wise thing to appoint him based upon the conduct. And nobody is prejudging, are you guilty of some criminal law federally or state? And that's why I wanted the sheriff to come here. I personally talked with him on the telephone. I think that he ought to share that with you in closed session. Administrators generally don't come to meetings unless they're invited to attend. And just because he saw or didn't see on the agenda this appointment, why would he come unless he's appointed?
Invited.
Yeah, rather, thank you. Invited. So I don't think I would fault the sheriff. If you invite him to come at a time that is convenient to everyone, I'm sure that can be arranged. But I don't think one can fault him for not coming just because it's a public agenda and he ought to know better to be here. I don't agree with that at all. If you want to debate the appointment, I'm certainly willing to debate the issues of the appointment. And I was willing to do that the other night. I do oppose the appointment, but I think it's a very diplomatic way of tabling it to another date and time. If you don't want to do that, you want to have a debate on the issues, on the merits, then so be it, but then be prepared to air the dirty laundry in public. This isn't personal. Every time I see Frank Pacetti, we have a good word back and forth. We shake our hands. Hello, how are you? Met him the other month or so ago over here in Wendy's with my son. I introduced him. It's not personal, but it is on the merits. So I think the motion that Supervisor Johnson and Supervisor Decker here is wise, and I still think the safer thing to do is to meet with the sheriff. That was the instruction of the motion, and that was the vote of the board. So follow it.
So is it just for me to be clear for my purposes, your line of inquiry is really around whether or not whatever the investigation is somehow has conflict with what his position is as far as being on Workforce Development Board. Yes?
Well, I can't answer that. I think that's something for the sheriff to answer. I'm not here to discuss the merits of that. I think that's for someone else to discuss in a closed session. So okay. I don't want to get into what that's all about.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, that's why I tabled it, because I don't know what the sheriff knows and what information he's going to give us. And it may be the information he gives us is A-OK, and that we don't feel that it makes a difference to his appointment or not. But I don't want to guess at what the information he would give us. I would like him to tell us what it is instead of speculation and things like that. And that's why I made a motion to table.
Supervisor Redzi.
I'm agreeing a little bit with Aaron on that, but I agree with Ed and Mike a little bit about the innocent thing. I do have to admit, I read the police report. This is really odd situation. And I'm not saying he is guilty or any of that, but just the whole thing is very odd to me. So I would like to hear the sheriff's side of things, because I think that would help. So I'm going to vote for the table on that regards. But I don't know this man. And like Ed, I agree with you, Ed. He's guilty and, you know, innocent until proven guilty. So I
Supervisor Johnson.
I just want to speak to the personal issue, too, that Chairman Kubicki brought up. I'm actually, Frank and I actually have a very good relationship. We sit together on the Joint Services Board, and as a matter of fact, we bought a hunting trip from him from one of the policeman balls. I mean, there's no ill will here on the Frank on the part of us towards Frank. It has nothing to do with that. Again, this is just purely, mostly, the fact that it was referred back to committee with the instruction to have the sheriff here. The sheriff came here, or sent Charles here, because it was at the last minute last time, too, and it wasn't on the agenda, and then this time he wasn't even informed. So I think that we need to honor what the board decided when they sent it back, what the motion was at that time, and have him here to speak. So. Again, I will vote to table it.
And to follow that up, I'm okay with meeting at a separate meeting before our normal meeting, the first Monday of the month, if it fits into all of our schedules and the sheriff's schedule too.
Me too.
Anybody else?
And I guess, why is Frank not here? I mean, Frank. Could be here too, as well.
Yeah.
Reappointment. Generally, reappointments aren't. It has never been the committee's request that reappointments appear in front of them.
Okay.
So that's.
It's been new people we count.
And I was unaware that you were requesting the sheriff's department. But if that is the request of the committee, we can notify.
It slipped my mind this time. Okay. For some reason.
So we're going to schedule another meeting.
I said I'm open to it. Requiring it or anything. I'm just saying I'm open to
it. If that's what has to happen, that's what has to happen.
Do we need it by a certain time, or can we just do it at our next one? So we could just do it at our next one.
When does Workforce Development meet again?
I believe they have a December meeting, but this your next committee meeting would be before that.
Yeah. Our next meeting is before that anyway.
But it doesn't mess with our quorum or anything like that, so it's not an issue there.
All right. Sorry. If it's the intent of this committee to fully fulfill every aspect of advising consent, which is technically what this function would be considered, that's a good thing. If there's something else at work, that's bad. And that'll come out. That's all I want to say. Fair? All right. So there is a motion to table this to next meeting with the expectation or hope that someone for the sheriff or someone from the sheriff's department will attend, maybe Kenosha and Racine, because I think they're doing it jointly because of the nature of the proximity.
I don't know. No, Racine has to go to the FBI. Plus, I don't know if we can make the same time. I don't know. We can invite them. But
we can't make him come either, but we can ask him.
Yeah. So.
Well, I think the sheriff should come, you know.
The sheriff Racine turned over the investigation
to
Racine.
Yep.
And the FBI, according to the Kenosha News, that's what they said, but the Kenosha News said that the Human Services Board was meeting tonight at 6:30.
Committee?
No, the board. Read the paper, that's what it said. So the Kenosha News is not a reliable source of information.
Yeah, it's a report.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought what you were saying was somehow relevant.
No, that, like I say, so that's the papers where we're getting our information. Okay. And it's at the Racine Sheriff's Department. And
see, I was at Joint Services when
and that, Joint Services. That just goes to my point as why I'd like the sheriff here instead of getting information from the paper or wherever, instead, you know, getting it straight from the sheriff would be probably more accurate than the paper.
But the Kenosha sheriff, Kenosha sheriff's not involved in the investigation.
Let's take the vote. I'm calling the question.
To your knowledge.
All right, so there's a motion to call the question. Is second on that?
Second.
All right, cool. So we're ready to vote.
I'm calling the question.
I'm calling the question, or tabling?
I'm calling the question. Okay.
So all those in favor of calling the question?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye.
No. Okay, can
now
we
the,
go ahead?
The
go
vote
ahead. Go
to
ahead.
Table. So it's yes to table, no to not table it. Whatever
call,
else would happen beyond
roll
that.
Call?
Roll call.
Sure, we'll do a roll call.
Do roll call again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Youth and governance, congratulations, you get to go first.
So yes to table. Yes to table it?
Yes to table, no to table it.
Not to table.
Yes.
Yes to table.
Yes. Two yeses from the youth and governance.
Okay, David Hellman?
You're supposed to do me last.
No,
okay.
Oh, first.
yes.
Michael Gable?
No.
Greg Redsloff?
Yes.
Leah Blau?
Yes.
Aaron Decker?
Yes.
Anita Johnson?
Yes.
Stephen Arrington, not here. Sarah Klimisch?
Yes.
Here
yes.
Okay.
So can I just make one comment?
Yeah, sure.
Whoever between you two, make sure we have this person, please,
sure,
set up so we can get this done. Thank you.
Will do.
Thank you.
You
that's
know
all.
Five Pacetti to be here too.
We'll have that conversation.
I bring food, that could be tense.
Mr. Chairman, just a suggestion. If you're going to meet with the sheriff and you want to meet with him in closed session, it has to be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I presumed you knew that, but just a reminder.
So we should have put it on the agenda as a closed session?
Possible, because that way if we don't want to go into closed session, we can stay out.
Yeah, because you may want to discuss that privately without the public, without Frank Pacetti or anyone other than county supervisors.
But if you say closed session, that means we have to go into closed session. If you say possible closed session,
we can
decide.
Does this fit the definition for closed session since he's not an employee? Does a board member fit?
You can check with the corporation council.
Okay.
I believe so.
Okay.
But for a
public appointment, you can go in closed session. I thought it had to be to do with employment
or
bidding.
Check with the corporation council. That would be my view.
We will.
Agenda item number 5, presentation from the Division of Aging and Disability Services on the Dementia Care Initiative.
We're going to tag team here. I'd like to introduce you to Rebecca Dutter. Rebecca is our Adult Protective Services supervisor and a very busy lady. our unit has been very busy lately. But We are excited about a number of the dementia care initiatives that we have, that we've been able to start in the program. But and this is dementia care is really on the top of the minds of people throughout the nation and in the state, and it certainly has had the initiatives have had bipartisan support in the state because everybody is concerned about the growth, the projected growth in the number of people with dementia. And I apologize on we didn't get the color copier didn't work, so you don't get to see all the color that in our slides. But just to emphasize the number, 1 in 9 Americans are estimated over 65 are estimated to have Alzheimer's or related dementia. You can see by that bar graph in the next one, the numbers are growing tremendously.
Is that because the population of the aging
yes.
is getting bigger, or
yes.
is this proportionately to the aging population, or disproportionate?
Proportionate.
Okay, so it's
because as the baby boomers are moving into age, and as they age, so
okay, it's not some weird skew.
No.
It's just because
no.
of the baby.
Although
boomers.
Interestingly, Becky is seeing an increase in the number of. Early onset dementia as well, and we're not sure what the reason is for that. But
and what age is early onset thought to be of?
40s, 50s, and early 60s. It's
okay.
Usually before that Medicare age where they count that as being early onset
okay.
dementia.
Okay, thank you.
So the reason that everybody is concerned about it is the individuals themselves, the loss of function, independence, and quality of life. The physical, emotional, and financial stress on families, the loss of productivity and income among working family caregivers. In fact, the state just came out with a toolkit for employers, and we're going to be getting that information out to employers because of and there are numbers that they have in terms of the loss of productivity due to employees needing to take time off to care for family members.
Laverne, is this covered over FMLA?
It could be, but most FMLA is unpaid. Certainly the increased long-term care costs, both on state and federal costs, I think it's about 40% of nursing home residents are estimated to, it's estimated that about 40% of nursing home residents have dementia. And the increased costs to the county as well, the time of the adult protective services staff, law enforcement, when they, in terms of picking up individuals that are combative or wandering or just getting called to the home because of the it could be husband gets called to the emergency room, and then the spouse at home has dementia. What do we do? Guardianship costs, corporation counsel involvement as well. The bar graph that you see next to it, adult protective services cases, and Becky can talk to this. Unfortunately, you can't see the colors, but certainly. A large portion of that increase is related to dementia. Becky, do you?
Sure. I think what's interesting to note, and again, I'm sorry that you can't see the colors on it, but for the last 10 years, we have had a 53% increase in the number of cases that are coming to Adult Protective Services. That certainly, the majority of them are issues related to people who are dealing with dementia. The biggest growth that we've actually seen is what we call the welfare checks, and those are checks that we do oftentimes separate or together with law enforcement on situations where there's some combativeness in the home. Oftentimes that is dealing with a spouse that has dementia or a person in the home that has dementia. Those welfare checks are up 306% in the last 10 years. Adult Protective Services growth just since the last year is we are up 35% overall. Our cases are dramatically increasing. That's a huge jump in 1 year based on what we've seen in the last 10 years. And I think, again, that's pretty consistent with what we're seeing for the amount of people who are entering the system that have dementia-related issues.
You don't classify Alzheimer's and dementia differently, do you necessarily? Definitely diagnosed with one or the other, they're kind of...
Alzheimer's is one form of dementia, the largest form of dementia, but there are others. Okay. Other types of dementia.
Okay, but like the Alzheimer's associations and those kind of organizations, how do they play into this, or don't they necessarily?
They do. We work very closely with them. We have a number of efforts that are collaborative. We have somebody from the Southeastern Wisconsin Alzheimer's Association that comes does visits with families sometimes at our office. We work together on, we're going to talk a little bit later about memory cafes that that we've organized in conjunction with the Alzheimer's Association, where family caregivers can bring their loved one and they can get information and enjoy just some time out.
I understand, yeah. Okay.
And we also refer people to them for information. They certainly have a lot of detailed information about dementia and resources.
But they can't really treat their field associations, right?
No. Okay.
They just provide community information.
Okay.
The next slide I included because it shows the abuse, neglect, and exploitation cases that Adult Protective Services see. And what you can't see on you can't tell what it is, but there we have seen a large increase over the years in the number of cases of physical abuse and financial exploitation. And when I was telling a story to the Human Services Board when I started many years ago, those were just a handful. I could count on one hand the number of financial exploitation cases, and now they're a significant portion of the cases that Becky's unit is seeing. And included here because I think that people with dementia are particularly vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. And so I think that's also contributes to the increase of those cases.
Is it also because there's a larger number of them as the baby boomers age? You know, people, there's so many of them, it'll be easy to find one that I can dupe.
Sure.
70% of all of the financial abuse cases that we investigate are family members who were investigating.
70%?
Wow. 70%.
Disgusting.
And that's pretty consistent. Wait,
say it again. 70%. Say the case.
70% of all the alleged perpetrators
of financial abuse
are family members.
Is it family members that have like power of attorney or control or have access to the accounts necessarily, or is it people that are somehow duping? You know what I mean? Where there's a difference where they actually have direct access where they can write out checks, or are they duping the person with dementia into signing over things?
I would say it's about half and half.
Okay.
There are certainly a lot of issues related to those who have fiduciary powers through a financial power of attorney, but there's certainly also those, and we unfortunately deal with investigations all the time, where it's, you know, grandson or granddaughter has taken grandmother's bank statements and now is on the internet, able to access their bank statements via the internet. Grandma or grandpa gives them permission to utilize their car to go get groceries, and then they take advantage of that situation. We have cases that range anywhere from, you know, small amounts per month to we have $3 million plus investigations that we're conducting right now. So this is a big issue. It's the fastest growing crime that we're seeing actually in our country. Kenosha is consistent with that. And unfortunately, there's lots of issues when it comes to dealing with these financial exploitation cases, because you've got a lot of misunderstanding about whether it's criminal or civil. You've got a lot of family members that, you know, the adult is vulnerable and doesn't want to say, my goddaughter, granddaughter, whomever it is, has taken my money. They're not oftentimes good witnesses because they may have a form of dementia. So it's what we're hearing from the federal government is that we're only seeing about one in every 14 cases. So if we're seeing this amount, our financial abuse cases are up 35% over last year and 265% over the last 10 years. So if we're only capturing one in every 14 that's happening, this is an epidemic that we're not even close to capturing.
Well, and it's hard to catch people that have power of attorney because they're allowed to do it.
Yeah. Well, actually, they're not. That's they're true. Not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to misuse
but it's,
somebody else.
Right, but it's easier to...
Correct. And then there's
and
that,
get away with it.
Right, and then there's the assumption, I think, publicly that people think, well, you know, that's just a civil issue. Well, it's really a crime. Anytime you take something from another person, it's a crime. But it's that's a view that we have to really change in society.
So how are you finding out about these cases if the, you know, the elderly person who's being affected by it is afraid to, you know, turn their grandson in or their granddaughter because...
Right.
You know, for whatever reason.
Well, we work pretty closely with the banks. A couple of years ago when we realized that this part of our job was getting really out of control and we were having to work a lot with the police department, we sort of carved out a position in the Adult Protective Services Unit where we actually hired a detective, a retired detective from the Kenosha Police Department, who is handling the majority of these investigations. So she works pretty closely with the banks, with financial institutions. We also oftentimes, unfortunately, find out about it when the person has to apply for benefits. They've gone into a long-term care facility and now there's all this money. The person then isn't eligible for services because this money is missing. They enter in all different ways. Sometimes we have good family members who find out about it, but I would say the majority of them are coming from financial institutions at this point.
I mean, are people attempting to shelter the money? Because I'm my mother's caretaker, and basically, she's got her money, and I can't touch it. You know, I mean, I provide her, but like I say, I could see where people would want to move this out because once they go into a facility, the first thing they do is take all the money. So if you're sitting there, I mean, I could see where people would want to...
No, I don't think it's that. I think certainly there's a degree of that happens, and people just unfortunately aren't aware of the laws maybe and do it inappropriately, but I would not say that that's the majority of the cases. The majority of the cases, there's definitely an intent to take from the individual.
They're using that money most often.
So then the people that are being affected, like in these cases, the patients with dementia, their family members are doing this to them?
70% of all the cases, it's a family member. I mean, we certainly see our scams and schemes.
Right.
We see those that are advertised. That happens everywhere, but the bulk of them is coming from a family member.
And it's not entirely people with dementia. We have many very sharp individuals that find themselves duped, and whether it's by family member or a scam. So it's not entirely dementia. It's just that you're more vulnerable if you have dementia.
I think we've all, if you haven't seen it, the Mickey Rooney story came out a couple of years ago prior to his death about how he was manipulated by a family member. It just goes to show that it doesn't really have boundaries as far as where you sit socioeconomically or where you are in your life. It's certainly something that can happen to anyone, and the repercussions are huge. We actually see that the death rate of folks that have experienced financial exploitation, they die 2 times sooner than those who have not experienced any type of exploitation. And that I think what people think the reason for that is, you know, when money is taken from you when you're in your 40s, you can recoup that money. But when it's taken from you when you're in your 80s, there's no way that you can recoup that type of money. And it's, it's a heartbreak to know that a family member that you've trusted has taken advantage of you in such a way that has put you in a really awful situation in a lot of cases that we see.
Do a lot of these people even understand? I mean, a lot of them probably don't even understand what's going on, right? I mean...
Well, I would say about 50-50. About 50% of the times, they really don't even know that it's happening. Then we explain it to them, and, you know, there might be a little bit of them that believes that it's happening, but they don't really want to believe it. And then there's the other half that absolutely understands that's happened, and either chooses to not move forward with any type of prosecution or does choose to move forward. And that either way, they certainly have their issues moving forward in the criminal justice system.
You know, my mother's been, like I say, she got a phone call. They wanted to come out and check her heating ducts and vents. Well, she said, yeah, come out. I happened to show up that day, and the guy's standing there. Well, I got a furnace guy. Yeah. You know, But he was all set to come in the house, and the tree guy's waiting out in his truck, to, I'm sure, to fix whatever. I mean, they call on the phone.
Yep.
And, you know.
And that generation tends to be a very trusting generation. Mm-hmm. If somebody contacts them to say, you need this, they tend to really believe it. So we spend a lot of our time doing community education with the older population just to say, you know, if somebody's calling you on the phone unsolicited, you really either need to call them back, check on it, contact someone that can look it up for you, a family member or whatnot. But they do tend to, you know, they're not, we tell people all the time, hang up on them. But that's rude to them, and they're not going to do that. So we have to work through a lot of those issues oftentimes with a lot of our victims.
She gets 20 letters a day asking for money.
Absolutely.
You know, $10, $5, you know, and if she had her druthers, she'd give to every organization in the world because she forgets about it.
Yeah. My mom's in her 80s, and it's the same thing. And they constantly are bombarded with ads and people actually even coming up to her door, knocking. And you know, we actually had an incident with somebody who said they had to look at her meter because there was a problem. And I mean, all kinds of things, you know. But we've got her so that she won't open the door for anybody. And she always calls one of us if somebody ever contacts her for anything.
And that's,
you know, there's a lot of people who don't have somebody to do that.
Absolutely. There are people that don't have someone, and then there's a lot of people that just choose not to reach out too. And that's, I think, where the education piece falls on us, to be able to say to them, you know, here's the warning signs, and here's, you know, there are certain things that organizations don't do. Like the We Energies is not going to just come to your door. They're going to send a letter. They're going to call. They're going to do, and that's the part of the education piece that we need to continue to work on.
Yeah, then the IRS, with people calling that.
How does the prosecution part, what's that like? Are we getting these people prosecuted who are doing these scams?
No. It's you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding, and these are really, really tough cases. They're tough because oftentimes you don't have a willing victim who's willing to talk about it. There might be some diminished capacity.
Easy to confuse, to get to sign contracts, to, sure, yeah.
So they're very challenging, and I think we do have a misconception that, again, these are civil issues and not criminal. So that's a barrier that we certainly have to work through with the criminal justice system.
I know with my mother, when I had the furnace guy, I called the police and said, hey, I don't know if this guy's honest, criminal or whatever, but, you know, she's in her 90s. I mean, but is there... And maybe we ought to register caregivers, so when you have a scam like this in the community, you could get the word out, you know. I mean, I don't know. They could be cheating, you know, the neighbor two doors down, and I wouldn't have a clue.
Right.
We do try to do that. We had one of our alert seniors called us that they had gotten a call, the one about the... they said that the Department of Aging was giving out a free lifeline, and the man was suspicious, and he contacted us, and we learned about it. We did send a notice to the Kenosha News. I don't think they picked it up at the time, but we do get things like from the state, other parts of the state, a certain scam is going on. They notify us. We notify all the staff so that if anybody calls, we can.
Well, most of this is a roving type of group anyway.
Yeah.
It can be, certainly.
But just to, if I can maybe talk a little bit more about our dementia initiative, the state is engaged in what they're calling a Wisconsin Dementia Care System redesign. So they've been doing a lot of work at the state level, and the areas that they're looking at is early screening, diagnosis, and prevention, safe and cost-effective care. Training for people who can care workers and others who encounter people with dementia, crisis prevention and management, especially where there are behavioral issues, support for family caregivers, and building dementia-friendly communities. The initiatives that we're involved in, we're doing a lot of memory screens throughout the county. We have people, just about all of our information and assistance staff and adult protective service staff have been trained to do memory screens so that we can do them in the office when people come, and then we've set up screenings throughout the county. so that people can be, at least have an idea. It's not a diagnosis, but they can have an idea if there may be an issue, and then refer them to resources that are available. We have, through the state, we've been one of the counties, we are one of the counties that have a grant for dementia care specialist, and that individual does consultations with families where there has been a diagnosis or concern about possible dementia, where they can meet with families and try to help families build a plan around the, to understand the diagnosis, understand the resources that are available, understand the trajectory of the illness and how they can better plan for that, and to also for crisis planning, to make sure that that they're prepared if there is a crisis on what the next step will be. There's also a program called LEAPS that's part of our requirement with the Dementia Care Specialist Grant. They want us to do, it's actually an evidence-based program that stands for Language Enrichment, or we always forget exactly what the acronym stands for.
Acronyms.
But what the program does, and there's a 0.25 position attached to it, and that person tries to match, recruit volunteers and match them with individuals at early stages of dementia for exercise. There's a prescribed exercise program. And then they also have socialization. They take them out during the week, and also at the same time provide respite for the family member who's caring for them. And that's something that it's a prescribed program, evidence based, that the state wants us to do along with that grant. We mentioned earlier the memory cafes. Becky, you want to talk more about those?
We actually have those monthly, and what they are is it's hosted at a restaurant. Recently, we've been working with Perkins, where individuals with dementia as well as their caregivers can come to kind of have a socialization event. It's a there's a lot of research out there that shows that people with dementia have less decline when they have normalcy in their lives, so their stabilization is a little bit easier when they're socialized, when they're doing familiar activities, when they're engaging in the public. So these dementia cafes, which we also collaborate with the Alzheimer's Association with, are just an opportunity for the caregiver and the person with dementia to meet at a local restaurant and to participate in activities. There's usually a small presentation that's attached to it, and just sort of have an outing, which is both a break for the caregiver as well as a nice socialization event for those with dementia.
We also Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services started a program. It's they're called virtual dementia tours, and we do provide some additional support for that that program. They set up a room with various stations that you can participate in and feel what it's like to have dementia. Becky's gone through it.
I've been in Adult Protective Services for 17 years and have worked a lot with those with dementia. And I thought I would just breeze through this, and why am I doing this? And within about 10 minutes of being in this experiment, I wanted out, because it's so challenging. You have sound in your ears, you have gloves on your hands to imitate like the sensory deficits that you have. You're walking with things in your feet to sort of show some of the complications that those with dementia can have. And you have to do these minimal tasks, and you have to do them in a certain way. And it was more challenging than, I failed it. I know I did, but I did three of like the five things. So anybody that's ever interested in doing those, they're very educational. Feel free to contact us, and we've got several of them set up.
Can I go back to one of your screens here? Early screening, diagnosis, and prevention. What is that exactly? I mean, what is the early screening? How is it, like a online test kind of thing, or what?
No.
Do you? I'm curious because.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's actually a standardized test that's utilized. There's three tests that we use. One of them, believe it or not, it's called the Animal Naming Tool. Those who have dementia are not able to within 30 seconds to 60 seconds name animals. That's a sign of a cognitive decline. There's also a clock jaw, which has been around for a long time. That's kind of a predictor of those with dementia. They aren't able to follow 3- and 4-step commands, which is what drawing a clock needs to be. And then there's some memory tests that we do that are all standardized tests that are accepted in everyday practice. We sort of merge those all together to provide a score to an individual, and then we allow the opportunity for them to share that with their doctor, or if they want us to share that with their doctor. There really is no real definitive test that can say a person has Alzheimer's disease. There are some other dementias that you can be tested for, some neurological-based dementias, but a lot of them, and we're talking about the majority of all dementias, are Alzheimer's. There's no definitive test that's going to say you have this. But there are certainly some tests that can predict that, you know, you maybe are starting to have the beginning or the mid-stages of memory loss that are associated with a form of dementia.
What we would advise people is to see their doctor and to make sure that they do the testing for other forms of dementia. So, and that's kind of how you determine, you know, by ruling out some of these other causes.
And why, can I say one more time? I'm sorry. And I guess this wouldn't be, why wouldn't this be part of, like, people get older, part of their physical, this? I mean, you know, I get a physical every year. I mean, I go through the whole thing, but I don't do it. You know. Wouldn't this make sense to do it at that time, maybe? I don't know. I'm just guessing.
It could.
Because is early prevention in this area a good thing? Or?
Yes.
So.
It could be, potentially, but we're also, some people might be offended if it was offered routinely. It's also the amount of time that a doctor spends. One of the things we're trying to, kind of on another vein, we're trying to get in doctor's offices is testing for falls risk. And we're finding that it's very difficult for the physicians to have, because they're supposed to be seeing so many people within a short time, to actually do that. But they are, like with falls risk, they're beginning to look at ways that some ancillary staff, you know, in the office, whether it's a nurse or somebody else in the office, could do some of those tests.
Well, you know, I guess my point, maybe some of you would agree, I mean, everything physically you get, you know, in a physical, except
what's
going on upstairs in your brain. I mean, it's not, you know, not one thing. And you go and you spend a physical cost anywhere from $500 to $1,000 gross cost. If you're covered by health plan, that's cut down, of course, but So.
A lot of doctors, I will say, are very uncomfortable with giving someone a dementia diagnosis. They sort of feel like it's giving them a end-of-life diagnosis, and they don't want to be part of it. They don't feel comfortable, so they will refer them on to neurologists or psychiatrists, which, you know, we have a shortage of psychiatrists, so that's usually not an option. But they really want further cognitive testing before they're willing to give someone a diagnosis. I think they feel that it will negatively impact them if they have that diagnosis, and maybe there's some truth in that, but I think a lot of people would rather know early on, because there are a lot of preventative things that can be done once you have the diagnosis to sort of stave off the decline.
Actually, that's my question. Isn't preventative, I mean, in this area, at least as far as research, it's very limited. I mean, it's very limited preventative. That's why I was actually surprised to see it.
They're starting to find some things. They're starting to look at deficiencies, like there's a vitamin D deficiency that they're looking at the possibility of. There's some thyroid-related things that have shown some prevalence of Alzheimer's.
Sure.
So they're starting to look at those and certainly need to do more research, because there hasn't been enough done in this area.
I've been involved in some research for Alzheimer's specifically over the last 5 years. That's why I'm saying it's very limited, and the outcomes are very... we're not very solid, so I was surprised to see that. Going back to the testing, one place where I've always thought it should absolutely be done is driver's license testing. That should be a component in driver's license testing.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's one of the most difficult things for an elderly person to give up, their driver's license.
My mom just had to give up her license.
It's very difficult for them to do that. I had a 93-year-old mother-in-law who... you know, was 93, and, you know, it was very emotional for her to give up that driver's license, but we as a family had to step in. because there's no regulation saying you can't drive after this age, or we're not going to test you for this or that.
No.
So us as a family have to step in and take it away from them.
Well, even if you take the test, my mom took the test and failed, but then she went in and, you know, debated or argued with somebody, and so they said, oh, well, you can come back and take it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so now she's on this kick, and my brother took her out, and she had not driven in like 6 months. She still thinks she can. You know, a few lessons, and that she'll be okay. It's like, no,
yeah,
it's not going to work.
Yeah. I've always felt that we should have something better in place mm-hmm. to ensure that they're not driving. Because I know for us as a family, it's very difficult to take it away from them. We really can't legally.
You can't hide your keys.
My mother had
you
a physical.
You don't want to get that call, though.
In like January, she was 100% fine. Everything was good. And then in about April, she had these little strokes, not disability, but
TIAs.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. she's on medication, but she's never fully recovered all the way back. But she's 91 or be 92 at the end of the week. I mean,
good for her.
Why the state is recommending the screening and then the early diagnosis too? And when we talk about prevention, it's not necessarily to prevent the disease, but to slow the progression, so that they can advise people about the medicines that are available, about the like the LEAPS program and other things that can be done to at least slow the progression, and then to also prepare the individual and the family for the progression of the illness.
And LEAPS stands for?
They couldn't remember.
Language enhanced exercise at
prevention. Socialization. Prevention and socialization.
That's hey. Yeah.
There we go.
John, what does LEAP stand for?
Cheers.
Just a test.
Cheers.
Just quickly, and I know.
You're good. You came up with that. Congratulations. That was very good.
We'll never know.
That's the test. Yeah, that was a test. And you passed.
We do a lot of support for family caregivers in terms of there are caregiver support groups. We have some with a couple of pots of money, federal and state funds that we have that we can reimburse families for short-term respite. And then, of course, long-term care consultation and enrollment in family care. We have a class that we conduct, Powerful Tools for Caregivers, that helps individuals with information and empowers them to take care of themselves as well as their loved one. And then we want to talk a little bit about the Dementia Friendly Community Project. We did get a grant from the Helen Bader Foundation, and which is helping us to so we both the state grant and with the Helen Bader Foundation grant, we were able to do a lot more in terms of trying to have Kenosha County become a more dementia-friendly community. We're starting with a lot of, our intent was to start a lot with the western part of the county, and then, but we've been getting calls from kind of throughout the county, so it's really kind of exciting. What we're looking at in a dementia-friendly community is that people are met with public awareness and understanding that they can live as independently as possible, that they can continue to be part of the community, given support, that they can find their way around and be safe, and that they can access local facilities that they're used to, whether it's a library or shops or post office, etc. So we've just started the project in July. Lauren Zielsdorf is the person that was hired to a part-time position for under this grant. And already we had 9 businesses, churches and organizations trained on interacting with persons who have dementia. And I think we have a restaurant in Twin Lakes and
all of the library system in the Western County. The library system here in Kenosha County, the city will be trained in January, I believe it is.
Two churches have had a couple of trainings each, and they've really, all of these groups have really embraced the idea. Once they learn about it, they want all of their staff trained. Along with the training, we offer an environmental assessment, and all of them have accepted that. It's to look at things that they might be able to do to be, so that their environment can be safer for a person with dementia. So like the, I think in the restaurant, it was a suggestion of a better, clearer restroom sign or exit sign, just better signage. Someplace else, it was an area that would be better lit, or a lot of signage, I think, is a good recommendation.
Right. Certainly, we're not looking at cost prohibitive things for these organizations, because that would, it's probably not going to be something that's doable. But little things like in grocery stores, having more carts available that a person with dementia could sit in, or if there's resting areas at the end. I mean, even, and I guess a lot of these aren't even related to dementia, but just for older people in general, walking through a grocery store is intimidating if you're someone that doesn't walk as well anymore, and just to have like little areas, if it's a chair at the end of an aisle where somebody can sit and rest, certainly makes the experience a whole lot better. And we find that they're more willing to go out in public and do these things if they have just these little small, slight changes in their environment, which certainly helps them be more social, be more active, which, as we know, it's been shown, certainly keeps them in the community longer than maybe what they would have been.
Can, like I say, a store train the employees? I mean, obviously, I see them at the grocery store, older people, that you can see they're struggling. I always ask them if they need help, or, you know, if employees were trained to recognize this.
That's what we're doing,
That's
yes.
what we're doing,
right. Yeah. And, yeah, and it seems as if it is catching on, and more organizations are interested in that opportunity. And if they have their staff trained, and if they they do an environmental assessment, they get a purple angel sticker that they something that's being actually started in Great Britain, I believe, and then Wisconsin has picked up on it, and this is being done throughout the state. So if you see a purple angel, it's a dementia-friendly organization.
Really, it's going to get interesting too with the advent of more and more things going to kiosks. It's going to be more difficult for older people, you know, out there in stores, and the more things are going to be put in the kiosk type of mode purchasing.
Yeah,
I think awareness is rising altogether. Though, I mean, you see drinks now that enhance your memory, you know what I mean, and all the ginseng, and then
they make it virtually impossible for older people to open up a lot of things.
Yes, they I mean,
I get my mother milk, and the first thing I do is crack the top, because otherwise she'd be 10 years. I still can't get the donut box open. That's just not an issue.
Agenda item number 6, mental health study update.
Okay, we are moving along. We're very excited. Our consultants have, I think I reported to you that the consultants we hired, the Sanika Santala, is she had a positions in the mental health, DHS high administrative positions with the Department of Health Services and with the mental health office. And Dr. Her husband, Dr.
Greg Schmidt,
who is a retired or semi-retired psychiatrist. He worked for La Crosse County was in charge, medical director of their behavioral health unit, and also worked with the UW-Madison School of Medicine. They have met, they've gone through all of our services at Kenosha Human Development Services. They spent a day there. They have talked to the Corporation Council. They've talked to, we've met with three hospital systems thus far. We've got
meetings. Reached out to local providers.
Have met with a number of the providers, law enforcement. They had
judges.
A meeting, and then we've got a meeting scheduled with the judges and with the community health center, and with I think one more hospital system. And we're finding there's a lot there, and I think we're going to be very pleased with the report and. And we'll be learning a lot. We're certainly, the meetings with the hospitals are very informative. We're finding everybody very cooperative and wanting to work together with the county. How we sort out all of it and is going to be a challenge, because there's a lot of information there. But I'm real optimistic that we'll have a good report that comes out of it. In the meantime, Kenosha Human Development Services has recruited a nurse practitioner after almost a year.
Yeah.
So that person will be starting January 1st. But we still need more.
So. Where did you recruit her from? Locally?
No, wait.
Did she just finish her education, or
she? As nurse practitioner, she still has the specialty for the mental health specialty. She still has some time to go on to complete that. But I can't remember where she.
Really.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if somehow we got here from another area and how you did it, and if we can keep doing it.
I think she's.
She's local.
Yeah, we didn't recruit her from Hawaii or anything. So
okay. Yeah, good luck.
Even from Madison or Milwaukee, you know what I mean? Even if we can grab them from Madison where they're finishing school, or Milwaukee.
Yeah, they'll stay in Madison.
Well, yeah. Chicago area.
Yeah, absolutely. We should be able to grab them. We have so many universities around here. You know?
Certainly, we've learned that the shortage of psychiatrists is a big factor of the also with the shortages of beds, because if they don't have the psychiatrist to cover, then that's a problem. And everybody is having the same issue. But they're all interested in working with us on maybe we could form some cooperative approach to recruitment.
I have a quick question. And if Medicaid, is the amount of Badger Care or Medicaid towards mental health decided by the state, how much they're going to give to that? I heard there's a variability on that or not. Is that dictated by, I mean, just for, go ahead. I mean, am I on the right direction here that there's, I heard that maybe Wisconsin's a little light on that, possibly, from compared, do you see my question?
Well, there's a couple, if you talk about provider reimbursement, then there was just an article in the Milwaukee Journal about they're actually going through almost exactly the same thing we are, and what they are blaming the.
You mean Milwaukee is going through?
Yeah, okay. Milwaukee County. Yeah, in terms of shortage of psychiatrists there too, but they are they feel that we have one of the lower Medicaid rates for so the Medicaid rate for psychiatrists is low.
Medicaid?
Pardon me?
Or Medicare?
Out of Medicaid.
Medicaid, yeah. Okay. And so that's part of it. In terms of other Medicaid services, the previous biennial budget where some of the services were expanded. And so there will be a big, and it's all the counties are gearing up. This was the money that we were, the matching funds for the comprehensive community services that we were able to access by joining together with Racine County. And that is now expanding. So I think that Wisconsin's Medicaid expenditures for community mental health services will grow as that program grows. Now, however, they just did, so that was with the previous biennial budget, and that's still growing, and we're still adding people, but it takes a while to gear up. However, in this past biennial budget, they approved a 48-month limit on enrollment in the Badger Care program. So all of the for childless adults, so all of the people that we were able to enroll in Medicaid last April, 500 some people who were low income, childless adults who are eligible for Medicaid. If this gets approved by the feds, what the legislature just approved, then in 48 months they could potentially be ineligible for Medicaid, and that could be then a problem at that point. But I don't know whether the state will get a approval from the federal government of that provision that they passed. So there are, the answer is kind of complicated. So there are different parts of Medicaid, but the psychiatric rates are low. And there are some I understand that there are some states where the, I think we talked to you before about at the institutes that Medicaid does not cover age 22 to 64. However, and that's a federal requirement. However, some states have picked up some of those institute costs, like for say 30 days of the stay in the institute. And whereas in Wisconsin, they put that on the county has to pick up that cost. There are a few states I understand that where they'll pay some of that.
Anything else? Any other businesses authorized by law? Any member comments?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
First, Supervisor Becker, second by Supervisor Johnson. Union governance.
Aye.
Committee.
Aye.
Aye.
Do some business not authorized by law.
Thank you very much for those presentations. They were very,
thank you.
Very good.
Is your pencil?
Pen. Tis. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry. Sheriff. I knew it was on for tonight, but I didn't think.
Just got it.
Because Ed had called me, so I guess I had to pick it up.
Hey, John, I hear there might be a football game on tonight. There wasn't any on yesterday.
That's true.
Yeah.